Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
It's your weekender with the Anfield Wrap. Neil Atkinson, Amelia Bonner, Mike Nevin and Adam Melia. We are also going to be talking Josh Sexton's with Liam Smith to talk about his upcoming fight. We've got Daniel Storey talking about women's football and Yawa Wusu talking about the music project that's going on at Anfield. That's everything you need on your weekender to set it all up. But the football is back. Seven games left to go. And Mike Nevin, how's your bottle? How are you feeling about Sunday?
Not great. I think in terms of the league games left, this is probably the hardest one I think we've got. Sounds a bit mad talking about a home game in that sense, but these are the best opposition that we've got to face. Spurs is a good side. I know they've lost loads this season, but they've been when they've won, they've been impressive. And they came through that period where they were without Kane and Dele Alli really well. The irony is that since they've come back, their results haven't been as good. But nonetheless, I think it's just that classic fixture, isn't it? Liverpool versus Spurs. The history of it. I think it was something like between 1985 and 1912. They hadn't won at Anfield. They've won a few times since, but yeah. 85 is quite a long time ago. In my head, it isn't. But
in your head, it's yesterday.
Yeah. So it's a difficult game. I think if Liverpool win this one, then you can see a path. And it seems like seven games feels like the run-in now that the international break is out the way. You know, this is the thing now, isn't it? And for everyone, you know, and as much as I'm delighted to still be in the Champions League, that is a little bit of a complication.
It's a complication. The gaps are good, Adam. I think I was just looking before. The gaps are good between these games. Everything looks quite nice. Set up for a big April. This one, we're going to talk about the team news, all of that sort of stuff. But first and foremost, City play first. They play first a few times coming up, and I don't think that'll have a psychological effect in that. What happens if they win? We've got to win. What happens if they draw? We've got to win. What happens if they lose? We've got to win. I think that everyone's a bit beyond that. But there is a point, isn't there, where this could become a little bit tiring. And you just think, just start this off with a victory on Sunday. I mean, it just is that simple.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty confident, to be honest, which worries me because, you know, I'm not always that confident. But I think as long as our heads are right, we will turn Spurs over. Their form is patchy at best. I think the two-legged Dortmund result probably puts a bit of a positive spin on what's been a difficult month and a half, really, for them results-wise. They lost at Burnley. I watched that match. They lost another one as well. I can't remember what it was. I think they've lost 3-1-2, drawn one since the start of Feb. So, you know, it's not massively scary form. I know what Mike means, though, because every time I've seen them under Poch, they've been really good, and I do think they're a good team. But I think we're a really good team too, and I think that I'm going to try and not kind of build every match up as the big one, yeah. Because I think I did that for Fulham, and I still think it was. I think still I'm sort of sticking to saying that was the big result, because that was the real straight on the back of a difficult European away, and like you say, the gap wasn't great then, and it proved to be a tough one. So I'm going to try and inject some calm into things.
I like the idea that Adam Mealy's going to pick what does or doesn't quantify as the big one. He's not having this one. He's
not having this one.
They're the same though, as well. They're the same if you think about it though, because they've got that same fixture, haven't they, at the weekend, Fulham. And they're looking at Man United is it Man United away?
Man United away still to come.
And they've got to play Spurs, and they've got that trio of awkward away games. So you've got to put that in perspective as well, the way they're thinking as opposed to the way that we're thinking, looking at our remaining fixtures.
So I'm trying really hard, and I haven't been able to do it yet, to not think of the wider context and like draw the red string lines between everything that's going on for everyone that influences, and the flap of a butterfly's wing means that we do or don't win the league. I think that it goes for kind of Spurs being in the Champions League and whether that's a more important game to them, whether it is or not playing Manchester City in the Champions League and playing Liverpool in the Premier League. They're both important games and they're going to want to win them both. I think them having had a bad run of things doesn't mean that we feel any more confident. It means that they're coming into it going, we win this one after the international break. And I think that...
Or we don't lose. Because that's what I think is interesting for Tottenham. I think it can quite easily become for them, don't lose. They're going for this race for fourth. And that's why I think early in the season, I was looking at this game thinking this was going to be one where they were going to turn up, Amelia, and be like, we're duking it out with Liverpool. It's one, if we're going to win this league and get back past them. Mm. But since then, they've had the bad run. And now it is one where you do wonder that they might just be a little bit more, don't lose.
No, for sure. And I think like there's no discounting that finishing top four is, well, it's not going to be as important to them as staying in the Champions League race, obviously, but it's still something that you would like to do. And I just think that Spurs, Liverpool, City, everyone needs to, we especially need to treat every game as just that game and stop trying to kind of look at all of the things that are going on around it and all the other games in hand and the kind of like, do you know what I mean?
Thinking are you just rejecting narrative? I'm fine with it. It's got my full support.
I've been tying myself up in knots thinking about kind of like, right, well, if they come to us for this and then the next game is this. And I think I just need to think we turn up, we play really good football and we win.
I'm thinking. Yeah. Also, I'm glad that the bit of narrative has gone about Tottenham never drawing all season. I had portents of doom about us being their first draw. I could just see it coming a mile off. So I was made up when they drew with Arsenal. Yeah. And I think, I don't know. I think we've... It feels like I'm looking forward to hearing what Klopp says and what his press conference says, because I think it might be one where he sets the mood a bit, but it feels like everyone has given their head a wobble a bit, and we are hoping to have. I mean, I feel quite refreshed after this international break. Don't know why, but
good rest in your legs.
It's possibly doing the live shows with the Anfield Rap in Ireland. But I feel like it's been a break, and that people will be looking forward to playing with the lads again.
Well, I think you can have the conversation, Mike, about City get to play first and all that sort of stuff. And I think that's a really valid conversation that it could make a difference. It might not. But I'll tell you what...
People's heads always fall off after City win, no matter what. Yeah, they'll beat Fulham and everyone will go, it's over.
And plan for City winning. But Mike, there is a thing here where I don't know if like the kick-off time. That's come nice for us. Half one Sunday, I'd have been thinking, oh no. Half 12 Saturday after an international break, I'd have been doubling down on my own.
I'd have been moaning. If it was us away half 12 after the international break.
It's one where I'm expecting a lot from Anfield on Sunday in a good way.
I think like, basically... Sunday games, traditionally, you expect a lesser atmosphere than you do on a Saturday. Maybe a lesser atmosphere than you do on a Saturday night. But it's got to that stage of the season now where surely everyone can just write off Mondays.
We've done that.
Honest to God. I mean, and then you think back to City in 2014.
Yep.
And that was absolutely riotous. I'm not quite sure what time that kicked off.
It was actually 1 o'clock. That was a Sunday early afternoon.
So you know, there's a benchmark. We're talking about 3.5 hours or 2.5 hours later than that. I don't really think it becomes an issue when it's 4:30 on any day of the week.
It's also Mother's Day, Mike. What do you think in terms of, does that make it better or worse of an atmosphere?
It's called an absolute murder at home. But
not just your home, I imagine.
Yeah,
I'd move Mother's Day to Saturday, personally.
I think we need to harness the hatred of the mothers, to be perfectly honest. Let them go out and have their day.
We'll meet them after.
Yeah,
with 3 points in our back pockets,
and a song
in our hearts.
What a perfect Mother's Day evening that is! Can you have a day evening? I don't know.
All in Sweeties.
No, I mean it is a good kick-off time with Liverpool because you know people will have had a bevy, and I know that sound. It shouldn't matter that, should it really? But
it does
to a game of football. But I think the fact that people have had a day. And you grow into that day, and
the clocks are changing as well. I keep adding extra ingredients.
I'm not happy about losing.
Will that make it lighter or darker?
No, I mean let's never know.
Darkness makes a difference.
Let's get this bastard brass tacks out, Adam. Come on. No, I mean it's just a massive game. I mean I know what Amelia's saying. Like just take away the context of you know everything around it, but it's a huge game for Liverpool. This and. They have to win it because if they don't win it, I think people will start saying it's gone. And that's the key.
Yeah, yeah. Because it isn't. It doesn't necessarily have to be. But if it does go wrong, a series of other things have to go wrong for other people for it not to be over, I think, probably. I don't know. I think it's going into it. absolutely acknowledging how big a game it is and not trying to be like, we'll just go and play a game, because it's not that. I think it's maybe going into it rather than seeing Spurs at home as the moment that we fuck it up, seeing it as like the point where we start to run away with it, because after that it all gets a lot easier, and maybe giving it the gravity it deserves, but in a positive way.
We can't afford to give City any extra impetus. I think that's what it is. So they lost to Newcastle, and I think the following night we drew with Leicester. So at that point, we could have put the hammer down a bit and taken, they were flagging anyway, and the fact that we didn't meant that they've gone and won all the rest of their games. So I think they're flagging a little bit now. Time will tell, but we can't afford to give them the extra little bit that they need to turn you know, difficult draws on 60 into wins, or when they think they're on top, like they did at Newcastle, and then, you know, the quick fire, there's a turnaround, instead of it being they were already 4-0 up at half time kind of thing. It's those things that weirdly there is an impact, and it doesn't exist in a vacuum. So that's what I'd say. I don't think it's over, but I think that we will give them a bit of extra impetus that we could do without them having.
There is last little thing on all of this, Adam, is I think the Champions League is really good. Mike said before it's a little bit strange. I think also the fact that it's Porto in the last eight makes it a little bit strange. It's not a European giant coming. It feels a bit more last 16, whereas Munich felt a bit last eight, last four. There is a thing here, though, where I think if Liverpool are looking for something to take the pressure off, it isn't league or bust. And I think that's really useful right now. For all of us, it isn't league or bust. And that's why I'm relatively relaxed. I know how big this is. I know how desperate I am to win the league. But I expect us to get a result against Tottenham. But if we don't, there's Porto home and away to come. And it's not gone anyway, but there's Porto home and away to come. And I think that can help these players. They don't have to kick every football. Like, it means absolutely everything. And I think that's no bad thing.
Yeah. It was. I think Munich and then the draw was huge and completely changed. I know that completely kind of changed how I was feeling about the Champions League. Sometimes cups open up in front of you, and you have to have got to the stage. Let's not forget we had a very difficult path to this stage so thus far, but now we're here. It has opened up in front of us, and I think that what we can take from that is we can now see what's going to happen in front of us, and you can imagine the team kind of getting some momentum, building up ahead of steam in that with the idea of Europe. I think for the whole season, I thought, like, for example, Salah. I could see revenge in his eyes as soon as the season started. So the fact that he can still see that is just going to spur him on, and he is one of those players that will bounce from game to game, and you know, as soon as he starts hitting the net again, it could be the thing. So you know, the draw was great, and again, I feel like maybe it's been a bit forgotten, like I said, about as soon as you beat Fulham everyone forgets how big we said it was before. The draw, you know, but that was the draw we said we wanted, wasn't it? We wanted Porto, we wanted City to get Tottenham. So as well as it being a big thing for us, and at the minute doesn't look too taxing. I mean, it might be a different thing if we do have a two-legged tie against Barcelona towards the end of the season.
To be fair, Porto could play well, and that happens. Yeah. And not everything might not pass for us like it did last season.
Porto could play well. I think having the home leg first helps us as well, though. Mm. I think everything at the minute.
I agree with that.
Everything at the minute has kind of landed exactly as you'd plan it. So there is definitely something in there where we're a bit lackadaisical, I think, around Porto. But I expect us to get through.
When I think it was last month, when Klopp said, like, neither one of them becomes more important, we don't sack one of them for the other, and everyone's head fell off. But I think having gotten through what were far more difficult matches than this and getting to this point now, like, it's obviously the right approach to say that, you know, God forbid something goes wrong on Sunday, it is still there. Neither of them are lost. They're both still absolutely possible.
The other thing that he's got all of a sudden, Mike, is... And City have got the same, and it's worth saying that. It's important to say that. But what he's also suddenly got now, without going into the specifics of who he should or shouldn't pick against Tottenham, because we'll do that in a little while, but he's suddenly got a fair few lads back available. That suddenly, it's actually difficult if you... I was saying before, it's actually difficult to pick a bench. Like, you could get to a point where you're actually not picking people on benches who previously have looked nailed on for 18s. you know, he may have to pick between Oxlade-Chamberlain and Shaqiri, between Sturridge and Origi, that, you know, that he may well have, does he put Gomez and Lovren on the same bench if he starts Matip? Does he put Matip on? Do you know what I mean? It could actually get to the point here where he's struggling to pick an 18, never mind an 11, and that hasn't looked likely for the last few months.
No, not at all, and obviously with the likes of, well, Gomez in particular, I mean, if he's going to be useful, and Oxlade-Chamberlain as well, if he's going to be useful in the last, whatever, six games of the season across both competitions, they're going to need some form of reintegration from the bench. None of them going to... I can't see any of them starting a game, so they've got to come from the bench, and then circumstances will dictate whether they'll get the opportunity to come on in 20, you know, for the last 20 minutes or so, whether we're 2-0 up against someone or where... I don't know, but basically, yeah, unless they get the chance to get some minutes, then they're not really going to have the chance to ultimately be part of the running as first team picks. I think with both Gomez and Oxlade-Chamberlain, you'd like to think that come a European Cup final, come a last league game of the season, they were sufficiently up to speed to start. Now, I think that's a little bit, I don't know, I think it's a little bit of an unrealistic ambition given the time that both of them have been out, but at the same time you want them as options.
I think from the comments that we've had from Klopp and the types of injuries, I think there is actually a distinction to be made between Oxlade-Chamberlain and Gomez. I think you're right about Oxlade-Chamberlain with everything you've just said, but I expect
he's not injured anymore
yeah. And I also think that we're probably getting to the point where Matip could do with a breather. He usually doesn't play this many games in a row. I expect Joe Gomez to be back. I'd love it if he threw him in against Tottenham, because I love Joe Gomez, and I think it's amazing how well we've done without him, to be honest, considering how much of an important part of the team he was in the first part of the season.
Fair play to Matip for that, by the way.
Fair play to Matip, definitely, but I think that he might... I'd love it if he threw him back in at Tottenham, but I think he'll play against Southampton.
Coming up, we've got Liam Smith, we've got Yao Wusu, and we've got Daniel Storey. This is your Weekender, and we'll be back with Amelia, with Mike, and with Adam, and I'm going to say that I think Joe Gomez starts right back against Tottenham. You've got that to look forward to. Delighted to be joined by Daniel Storey from Football 365, who wrote a really interesting piece about the history of women's football and the future of it. We're obviously going to focus on both of those parts, but one of the reasons why the piece grabbed me was it told the story of the secret history of how the Football Association, which should obviously be abolished, has spent many a year spending its time trying to suppress women's football throughout the game. And it's a little bit of a secret history in that it's not a secret that's kept secret. It's just that people don't talk about it anywhere near enough, and Daniel chose to. And Daniel, it is fair to say that for 70 years, the Football Association was very much committed to the idea that women would not play football in this country.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. In the late 1800s, women's football was growing in popularity to the extent that it was almost, I'd say, level with the men's game without much help at all. And the FA first moved to ban women from playing on Football Association pitches and told men's clubs that they could be punished if they allowed that women to train or use their facilities. And then more formally, in 1921, when women's football was more popular than men, during the First World War, when the men went off to war, women moved into the factories, and that enabled them to kind of forge this football culture, this football community, whereby they wanted to play on Saturdays, and women's teams were incredibly successful. They were playing in front of 50,000 people in this country, which I think people probably now cannot even imagine. In 1921, the FA they effectively banned women's football, and then in the 1940s they doubled down on that. Given the chance to remove the ban, they called women's football evil, and it wasn't until 1971 that ban was lifted.
It's that story is when we then have conversations about the women's game now, it's recent development. I'm not going to say renaissance because I don't think that's fair or true. But it's recent development, it's recent access to greater and greater crowds, it's recent on-off support, which is still, you know, very much short of where it needs to be. The context of all of this is to say that this was, you know, this is almost trying to help something that was suppressed for this long.
Yeah, and one of the points I make in the article is that kind of preempting and also reacting to a number of columns that have been written by people saying, well, hang on a minute, this is just positive discrimination. This is helping, you know, we're helping women's football, but actually it doesn't get the audiences that this help deserves. And to me, that's an absolute nonsense, because you don't get to do that. You don't get to suppress something for so long and then say, well, hang on a minute, we shouldn't help these people. They don't deserve it. They're not getting the crowds they deserve. They're not getting the crowds they deserve, and the players aren't played as much and therefore aren't as good as the men. And one reason of that is because that it was suppressed for 50 years. I think we have a very modern demand to kind of compare everything to the men's game. And that's something that women's sport in general suffers from, I think. I think we say, well, you know, they're not as good as the men, so why do they deserve our help? Well, A, it's a completely different sport. B, it's been, you know, kind of shat upon for 50 years. And now it does deserve some support, because the progress the sport has made is completely off its own back. It is completely done through goodwill, through determination, through a desire to kind of right the wrong of those 50 years, and good on them for that.
It's to then deal with the present. This is in the context of the Barclays deal for the Women's Super League, and also the huge crowd that the game's been getting in Spain, and also at the same time framed by the Champions League quarterfinals that have been taking place. Chelsea through to the Champions League last four. This time out, it seems as though it's interesting you say there that it's like a different game. In Michael Calvin's excellent book, he interviews Emma Hayes, and Emma's quite open about that tactically a lot of what works in men's football just simply doesn't work in the women's game. Like you almost have to switch your brain first and foremost to think about it a little bit differently.
Yeah, and look, the fact that there wasn't women's football for so long means it suffers through that lack of comparison. It means that, you know, if we compare the greatest footballers of now to yesteryear, you know, that tactically the game has changed, physically and medically the game has come on in, you know, it is a completely different sport to the men's game that was played 30, 40 years ago. But women's football doesn't have that comparison. So it's fighting for a lack of comparison, because what inevitably happens is that we therefore compare it to the men's game today rather than the women's game of yesteryear. It is completely different, but that doesn't mean that it isn't growing exponentially, both in popularity and in quality. And look, I'm not stupid. Part of the reason that you know, people roll their eyes at things like my article is that they feel like they feel like the phrase I get the most is, "Oh, women's football's being rammed down my throat." And part of this is a kind of culture of toxic masculinity, whereby men feel that something that they feel is in kind of inherently theirs, football, is being kind of swarmed across by women's football. And, you know, I'm not going to be able to change anyone's mind on that. I completely disagree with them. I angrily disagree with them, but I'm not going to change those minds. But like it or not, the examples you mentioned, you know, the Barclays sponsorship, the progress of English clubs in the Champions League, that is going to happen. You know, there's nothing that you can do about that. It doesn't matter how frothy-mouthed you get on Twitter about it. Nothing is going to change there. This is going to grow, because there is a, you know, there is a demographic for it, and there is a fan base for it, and that makes me very happy.
It's one where, you know, to talk about the future but link it back into the past. I think part of what you're saying there is that, for instance, I have, if I want to discuss the decline of the FA Cup, I have Ronnie Radford's goal to call back on,
yep,
and all of this sort of stuff. That effectively, not only is there not women's football, but also the women's football that has been in this country, at least from the early 70s, there isn't very much media. There's not very much footage. There's not very much example. You know, you can't call back on it. And what I think is really interesting about the point where the women's game is, and why, you know, it wouldn't necessarily hurt people to be a little bit more open minded, is that you're actually getting to see the beginnings of something. And that surely should be exciting. That's what I'd like to think, at least. You know, you're getting to see something that maybe in 10, 15 years' time we'll be looking back on and going, good Lord, we haven't half come on leaps and bounds since 2019.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is something, as you say, inherently pure about women's football, in that, you know, we are all obsessives and lovers of football men's football in 2019. But there are elements of the sport that are pretty distasteful, and that we choose to ignore or put to one side morally, because we love the sport and we don't want to feel like it's been tarnished in our minds. But women's football is a pure version of that. It is a sport in its infancy, but it's a sport that is growing like no other. And the example set by, you know, for example, the US women's team in the 90s moving onwards shows that, because we have an established football culture in this country, when you combine that established football culture with a sport that is determined to grow like women's football is,
it is only going to go one way, whatever people might think or say about it.
Last little bit is, how do we, when you talk about support, and I'm intrigued because I do think that there's so many things still to be ironed out, you know, not least there's been a couple of times recently where Liverpool's women have been kicking off literally at the same time as Liverpool's men's side, you know, and I'm talking about games against Bayern Munich, you know, so it's not even a comparison between what's the bigger game. There's still so much to do, isn't there, on the administrative side, before we even talk about the players, before we even talk about how they kick the ball, how they move around the pitch, the tactical setup. This, when we talk about infancy, we are still talking about a game where, you know, at every level, right the way down to grassroots, where administration still seems to do so much more work and make so much progress. It it should be an exciting gauntlet, but it is a gauntlet still to be thrown down.
Yeah, there's kind of two elements to that. First, you're absolutely right. There does need to be more administrative and logistical support given from the men's game, because the men's game, you know, particularly at the highest level, is awash with money. And both Manchester United and Tottenham's women's teams are going to get promoted most likely to the WSL this season, which means that next season you will have Liverpool, Manchester City, Manchester, you will have that top six in the men's game reflected in the women's game, and there does need to be greater support. But the other thing I kind of wanted to stress in the article, it maybe didn't come across that well, is that there was no one was telling people they have to watch women's football. No one's saying you have a moral obligation to go and watch women's football. If you don't want to do that, fine, that's no problem. The point is that it's growing off its own back. So the least you can do is not try and trample it down. The least you can do is not try and be negative about it and try and, you know, look down your nose at it. At least give it a fair crack of the whip. At least give it a fair shot, because I think you will be surprised that in, as you say, 10, 15 years' time, we'll look back now and say, Jesus, it's come a hell of a long way since then.
Yeah, no shadow of a doubt about that. I think that's a really, really valid point. Not everything is for everybody, but that doesn't mean that scorn should be poured on things that aren't for you. Thank you very much to Daniel. You can find his piece on football365.com. We'll make sure we tweet it out. It is available there. And at DanielStory85 to get the Twitter handle of Daniel. Sat in what looks like a really, really rather lovely location in his Twitter avatar, where I suspect he isn't right now, but he'll be, you know, it's a nice enough day. Thank you very much to him. And let's get over and get on with everything else. It is the weekend, and I've got Josh Sexton. And Josh, you've done the second interview of a Smith brother. You're collecting them.
Yeah, I am. Yeah, Joel Sanderson Murray was saying before how I've done two of four now, so I feel like I should be completing the collection sometime soon. But we were lucky enough to be at the Smith Eggington press conference today, and I did get a chance to speak to Stephen and Paul, so I reckon I can say I've completed the set just as that.
I think you've got that, but I like the sit-down interviews. And this one, you got 15 minutes with Liam, and he came to the Anfield App studio to do it as well, which was really kind. And it meant that just sort of being able to really focus on the idea that he's getting to fight on this card in Liverpool, getting to fight on this card in his own city. The press conference was at the Cunard. You know, it does feel like a bit of an event for Liverpool this weekend, in a weekend full of Liverpoolian events.
It's massive, yeah. British boxing is really on the up right now, and Liverpool has always been a really big part of the British boxing scene, but it's going to get that chance to really show that off this weekend. You know, the M&S Bank Arena, as it's now called, I wanted to call it the Echo then, but I can't. it's sold out for this, and you know, all the lads I know have been working really hard selling tickets, all the lads on the card, and there's so much talent on there as well, all sorts of fighters from Liverpool with different stories, and fighters from all over the place who've also got great backing stories as well. So yeah, it's going to be a really entertaining night of boxing.
You love your boxing, don't you?
Yeah.
So you follow it all the time. You've done some interviews for us today, not just of Liam, with a few others as well, but Liam himself he's a hugely talented boxer, and he's one who's, you know, he looks in great shape. He seems in great shape. He seems really positive.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a strange one, because he's one of them boxers who sort of can tend to go under the radar a bit. He's had a couple of losses on his record, albeit in sort of massive fights that, you know, some boxers are criticised often for not taking, and Liam's been taking them. And this one is a chance for him to possibly re-establish himself on the world stage. So I really hope he can get the job done.
Thank you very much indeed to our friends at Redsbet for pulling all this together. So this is our little chat with Liam in association with Redsbet.
Hi, and welcome to the Anfield Wrap special in association with Redsbet. I'm Josh Sexton, delighted to be joined today by Liam Beefy Smith. I asked Callum about his nickname last time. I've heard a few rumours about yours. Can you explain it to us, though, just for the sake of it?
Mine has just come from when I was a kid. I was fat. I was a big kid, and Dad just called me Beefy. We had a bulldog called Beefy as well, a little fat bulldog, so... I was called as a kid, and it just stuck at me.
It's not as cool as Callum's, like.
No, no.
Turtles one, yeah. Well, I rolled out the red carpet for Callum last time as well, so I'll do the same for you. You've held the WBO British and Commonwealth light middleweight titles. You've got a pro record of 26 wins, 14 by knockout, 2 defeats and 1 draw. So going into this, it's the 30th pro fight of your career. Where does this one rank amongst the fights you've had so far? And, you know, you've had some big ones over in America as well, but in terms of this being, you know, the importance you place on this one, where does it rank?
Yeah, definitely. That's what I'm going to touch on. It's one of the most important, as in I'm coming off the back of a loss. Obviously, I'm 30 now, so I want people to think, you know, I'm still got something towards the back end of my career, and I've had some big nights, obviously, with Canelo, world title wins, and Jaime Munguia over in Las Vegas, but this is just as important. A win here puts me back on that trail towards you know, another world title, and that's what I fully want to do. I want to be a two-time world champion.
And Sam's got the same amount of fights to you, Sam Eggington, your opponent. This will also be his 30th fight, but he's probably not got the sort of same sort of level of experience that you do, and you're obviously favourite going into this one. How does that affect your mindset? Does that help you in any way that you're going into it as favourite?
No, not necessarily, because some people, it'd be hard to win some people over. If I was to go and, like, you know, if I go and win on points, some people will probably slag me for it in that sense. But for me, it's a good opportunity. It's a good opponent, and, you know, I'm looking to make a good statement from myself, not winning 1, 2, or 3 rounds, just a good, solid performance that shows the levels. You know, I feel Sam has got a lot of miles on the clock. He's had 30 fights at 25 years of age or something, you know what I mean? He's crammed them all in. He's had some tough fights. He's had some tough losses. So I feel that, you know, I want to put on a performance where people look and think, nah, he was that step ahead.
And you mentioned that you're coming into this one off that last defeat to Munguia. How does that sort of affect your mindset going into this one? Do you think it's important that you've had them two fights over in the States, and then you're back home for this one, given the sort of importance on it?
Yeah, the fights in America, they just all add, you know, everything is experience, everything makes you, you know, I'm top of the bill here and 8,000 people. Some people could get caught, you know, in the headlights with that. Obviously, I've had the experience of fighting Canelo, 50,000 people in Dallas, and Jaime Munguia in Las Vegas. They all just help towards the experience of dealing with situations, and I've had some big situations and dealt with them well, and that's what helps me to deal with, you know, headlining in my home city in Liverpool.
And great for you to be coming back home as well. You mentioned coming back to Liverpool there and topping the bill as well, and it's a bill that's got so much, you know, local talent on it. How good is that for you in terms of, and good for the fans as well, I suppose, how much of an experience will that be?
Yeah, it's a privilege, you know, it's an honour. To headline a big show back in Liverpool, and for the public to be drawn to it, you know, as you said, they're expecting over 8,000 already, and, you know, you get a lot of walk-ins today and tomorrow, so I'm privileged, I'm honoured to be top of the bill on a card with such top fighters on, and it's one that I'm massively excited about.
And you've signed to Matchroom in the time since your last fight as well. What was the sort of thought process behind making that decision?
No, it was just like, I'd been with Frank Warden a long time. I'd been with him 10 years, and I felt I needed a change, whether it was, you know, Matchroom or any other organisation. And then just the sit down I had with Matchroom ticked all the boxes. You know, they're going from strength to strength at the minute with DAZN, with Sky Sports and the American connections. And I've seen what they're doing. They're doing good things with my brothers. So I feel it was a good chance now to see what Matchroom can bring to me for the next 12 months, and then, you know, we sit down again. But, you know, it all starts with Sam Eggington on Saturday.
And when we spoke to Callum last time, he mentioned that before he sort of signed up for the Muhammad Ali tournament, you'd all sat down as a group of brothers and sort of discussed that decision. Was this another one of them, maybe, where you sat down with Stephen and Callum? Because obviously they're there with Matchroom, as you mentioned.
Yeah, definitely it was, yeah. You know, we're a very close family. People mightn't see it, but we are. People think it might be just for cameras. It's not. And, you know, Callum wants to thank us now, because it was our decision that he went in the World Series. You know, his head was up his backside, and he was like, what do I do here? I've Darrell WC title for this much money in. He didn't know where, because they were messing him about in Michigan, in LA, and then Friday nights, and they were just messing him about. He said, oh, I can go in that tournament, WL title in that tournament. George Groves is definitely in it, and he didn't know any other fighters. We said, just the tournament's a no-brainer for it. You're confident of beating George Groves, so you'd be confident of winning it. And, you know, eventually that's what he done. He come out with both titles and he beat George Groves in the final. And, you know, we come out with a good load of money, and it was the best decision he ever made. The same with myself, as in the Matchroom deal. I went and sat with them and I said, look, Matchroom offered me that 3-fight deal, blah, blah, blah. And said, yeah, I think it'd be a good move for you.
And you mentioned how close you are with your brothers, given that they're all sort of in the same profession as you. How important is it for you to have that sort of support network in terms of the way that they help, the way you help each other, I suppose?
It's massive that the four of us have been in the same sport. We've all like come across the circumstances we're dealing with, you know what I mean? Like when I first come to a British title, I felt I'd been in that moment before because I had with Paul and Stephen, Callum the same. Callum, you know, when Callum got his big chance, he's been around big bills, he's been in a changing room on a ring walk, stands in the ring when me and Canelo are in the ring. You know, you don't really get much bigger than that, and that all adds how much the nervous energy we get for each other feels like it's yourself, and it does help, trust me, it settles you that little bit more.
And it's clear to see that family is sort of a big thing for you. And we've seen all the brothers when you fought as well. You've been raising awareness for autism, but with your sister also having the condition. Is that something that for you keeps you going when you're in the ring, and maybe particularly when you sort of have the setbacks in your career, that's something that, you know, that pushes you on?
Yeah, it's a big part of our lives. You know, she's an inspiration for all of us. She's a massive part in all our lives, not just the boxing career. You know what I mean? She's a big part of us. And you know, the more we can raise awareness for autism, the better. And the bigger profile fights, the bigger the awareness, the bigger the eyes go on the autism sign. And, you know, we get messages daily. What does it mean? We're so proud you've got that on. I've got a son or I've got a daughter with it. And we just get messages daily throughout. And it's good to see. And raising the awareness for it is just, for instance, my mum sat us down as we were kids. Well, not with your kids, but a number of years ago, and said, you know, your sister Holly, she's got autism, and the four of us said, what's that? You know, we didn't have a clue what it was, and people are still asking now what it is, so that's what we need to just keep doing, keep plugging it out, keep raising awareness so we get people to ask what is autism, or, you know, people understand that they're not on their own. You know, for people watching us, we're in the public eye, we're kind of sports stars, so I think, wow, they've got a sister with autism, it's not just us. Some people may feel alone because it's hard work, and you know, the more we can raise awareness for that, the better.
That's a great message. That Callum obviously reaching the heights mentioned before, the Muhammad Ali tournament. He's won the super middleweight title off the back of that. Do you still hold them title aspirations yourself? This is obviously going to be a massive fight for you in terms of re-establishing yourself on that world stage.
Yeah, definitely. And seeing Callum do it, you know, lit a fire back up in me and say, I want that now. I want all the accolades and the recognition he's getting. You know, it made me feel like I didn't appreciate mine when I had it a little bit more. But that might stem from Callum's world champion and the number one in his division. I was world champion and still weren't number one in my division. You know, there was another two champions above me and they were established champions. I was obviously a new champion. So that's where that may come into it. But again, going off previous performances, I feel I'm definitely good enough to win a world title again. And obviously with the momentum, you know, excitement, fire back in my belly, I feel I can do it.
British boxing's in obviously a massively good space at the moment. Do you feel like Saturday night is a chance for Liverpool to sort of put their marker down on the map as well? It's obviously always been a big part of the British boxing scene, Liverpool, but a chance with the talent that's on the bill and the fans who'll be inside the arena as well to sort of show that off.
Yeah, definitely. And I feel that, like, you know, it's when I said there today we've been starved of top nights, and I feel that, like, for the fights we've got in Liverpool, and I touched on this bill is a top car for locals, and it's done 8,000 odd tickets already, so that is a massive success. But what I meant by the show is a top show for local talent, but it hasn't got a star marquee name on it. We've had a Mia Khan fight there the other month. It hasn't got a massive name who's on stupid amounts of money, you know what I mean? It's a top bill with a lot of top fighters, and it's great to see that especially the local support have proper drawn into it. And for people, for promoters now to look at that and think, wow, Liverpool have done 8,000 tickets for that. We can go back there. And that's what we need to do, just kickstart a big revival in Liverpool for boxing, because we've got too many good fighters not getting them chances.
Yeah, and we've just been at the press conference there and obviously seeing the way that maybe some of the fighters were getting a bit heated with each other. It seems like you and Sam, though, have quite a lot of respect for each other. Does that sort of impact the way that you approach it in the ring, having that respect?
No, because that's where I feel that it's a different story to sparring in the fight. Obviously, when I get in a fight, I've got 10-ounce gloves on and I've got people screaming. That's when you get a spy for Liam Smith. And I feel that'll be the difference. Obviously, I'll be spiteful and I'll have 10-ounce gloves on. And you know, I can't come and disrespect him because, you know, he's helped me out in the past. He's turned up from Birmingham and sparred me when I've been struggling for sparring partners. And, you know, he's accepted to be a sparring partner and I've paid him for a full camp. You know, the good people, they are the good people, and I can't sit and slag good people. So that's where the respect side comes to it. But, you know, once we step in that ring, there won't be no respect. I want to do a job on him and, you know, I'll be looking to do that.
And it wouldn't be a pre-fight chat without asking you for a prediction of how you see it going then.
Yeah, I feel it'll be good. It'll be exciting because the two styles gel well. You know, styles make fights. Other people could beat Sam well easier. Sam could beat people easier than I beat them. You know what I mean? Styles make fights. And just man and Sam's fight will gel well, the styles. But I feel I do everything that little bit better than Sam. And like I said, with 10-ounce gloves on, and a spy for Liam Smith, I hit him too often, too cleanly for him to stay in the fight. And I feel I'll probably, you know, I feel I'll have him out today by 8.
And, you know, you're probably not looking beyond this fight in terms of what you have planned for the future, but there's been a bit of talk about you and maybe a couple of your brothers fighting at Anfield as well. That would obviously be something special to you as Reds and maybe a little league title to come potentially in the next couple of months as well.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, Liverpool in a great position for the league now, and it's great to kind of like, great to see we're competing with City. People are saying the City team are the best team ever and we're competing with them for the title. So that's unbelievable to see. But from a boxing point of view, you know, Anfield is a big part. It's a big thing on our tick list. And, you know, hopefully we can maybe add a world title and with Callum, go back there and see if we can get it over the line. You know what I mean? I think there was a couple of little stumbling blocks last time. I don't know whether we've missed a window now because it's only a certain amount of time you can fight there. But, you know, I'm sure within the next year or two, Anfield will be on the agenda.
I'd absolutely love to see that. Liam, nice one for joining us, and best of luck on Saturday as well. And thank you to Reds Bet for hosting this as well, and that's been another Anfield Rock special.
Excellent stuff there from Josh and Liam. Listen, Redbet are the lead sponsor of the Anfield Wrap in 2019, and we're really pleased to have them. Going to be doing loads of fantastic stuff around Aintree next week. Keep your eye out for that. But all the work done there by Josh, you can see some more interviews that he's done through Redbet's channels. And also, if you do want to gamble on that fight or anything else you fancy, please do consider doing it with Redbet. If you are somebody who chooses to do that, feel free to cross over. If it isn't for you, we understand it is not for you. We're not trying to pull people over for that sort of thing. And regardless, whether it is for you, whether it isn't for you, always be responsible in every decision that you make, well, around your money in general, certainly in the current climate, but especially where gambling is concerned. Thank you very much to Josh and again for Liam for that one. It was absolutely fantastic, a lovely conversation. And we will get over now to Yao Owusu.
And it's John Gibbons here for the Anfield Wrap, and we are in a purposely built studio in Anfield, just opposite the stadium. We're here on match day, funnily enough, as well, but we're here because we're here to talk about the Levi's Music Project. It's a studio that's been built by Levi's here across the road from Anfield. It's part of the Levi's Music Project that's been all over the world and has now come to Liverpool as part of... Well, their partnership with Liverpool Football Club that's running over the next year or so. And when they decided to do this project, they wanted the hottest guys involved, the biggest talents in Liverpool, the people who young people could learn from most. And obviously, Yao Owusu was their man, their go-to guy. I mean, Yao's involved in everything. He's management, he's a promoter, he's... What else can we say about Yao? He's involved in Lymph. He's the main dude in Liverpool. And was that enough of a builder for you, Yao? You're shaking your head.
You're going to get the snipers out for me now. I'm just Yao. That's plain and simple. But I'm privileged to obviously be involved in something like this, which, you know, anything like this when it comes to a city like ours, I think is very important. We don't get loads of opportunities when it comes to music projects that are kind of high visibility and part of something that is international. And I think this is a great opportunity. So I am glad to be involved.
Yeah, and it's a group of young people, all 16 to 24-year-olds, who had to apply. And I know the guys who were involved in the application process and choosing were... amazed by the talent that they got. He said, I can't believe, you know, these guys and girls who want to get involved, what they're doing on their own, and just really excited.
Yeah, well, you know, I say this a lot of times, like in terms of raw talent, I put Liverpool against any city in the world. You know, I think, like what I was saying before, sometimes we don't get those chances of interaction that can take a lot of artists to the next level. And, you know, there's a lot of projects in the city that do it. But I think what Levi's, I've got planned for this project in terms of the exposure to people of influence, like people like Loyal Carner, do you know what I mean? That are really going to allow these artists to actually soak up a lot more information, make connections with each other, but also these people, you can take them further in their careers. I think that's the pivotal thing about this project, which probably differentiates it from anything that's occurred in the city in the last 10 years.
Yeah, you mentioned Loyal Carner there. He was at the first workshop, wasn't he? He's going to be involved throughout. He's going to be performing at Sound City and helping the young people kind of with their performance as well. And just having someone like him who's, you know, a big Liverpool fan, he's very fond of the city, but also, you know, how he's gone about kind of his business really is really impressive, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, as someone who's a supporter of Loyal and his music and, you know, him as a person and his message, you know, it's great to have really authentic people involved in this project. We've had people like Hannah V come and speak to the group. We've had Terry Walker come to the people who are, you know, actively global icons and specialists in their field. But, you know, to have someone like Loyal Carner being the head of this, like to see him and his dedication, actually listen to every young person and engage with every young person, the first session, and then his kind of ideas and what he wants to bring to the table. It's very important because you see a lot of projects where they have figureheads that don't really get involved. It's just for the press or whatever. This is real. And, you know, I think every young person there, when they found out it was him who was the artist there, was like astonished and excited. That's what it's about, fundamentally.
So what have you been up to so far then? I know this, you've done quite a few sessions with them. Obviously, the young people got to know each other and everything, but what kind of things have you been doing?
You know, because I've got a background, even before music, in youth work and kind of, and you know, artist development and stuff is, you know, we've done a lot of things early on. We've kind of breaking down barriers. You get a bunch of 15 young people from all across Merseyside come together, and straight away you know what happens. Everyone plays the ball, everyone protects themselves. So we've done a lot of icebreak stuff where people have to come up and share songs and just say, I've worked on this, and then people give them feedback. We've done stuff where they've collaborated, we've done jam sessions, we've had, you know, guest speakers, we've had a producer, Hannah V, who's you know, had a top 40 record and, you know, publishing deal and toured the world with Alicia Keys and Rihanna and Jessie J as a musician, you know, come and work with them. We've had Terry Walker, who worked with Damon Albarn, who worked with Dame Dash, who worked, you know, who just done something with Slam Remy, who produced the Fugees album. And, you know, she's come and spoke to them about songwriting. So we've done loads of sessions where they've kind of got information and shared information, but a lot of practical activity, which has helped them kind of break down their barriers. And we honestly, within 4 weeks, myself and the team here at the Lighthouse and the team that are working on the Playmaker Group delivering the project, we've just seen some awesome barriers break down. And to me, and I said this to Amika as I was coming up, Amika, artist from Liverpool, but he's also a facilitator on the project. I said, I believe that this may be one of the best projects I've ever been involved in. And I don't say that lightly because I feel like I've been involved in some good stuff. But I just feel like some of the strides that these younger artists are making have been phenomenal.
I mentioned before Sound City, that's where it all kind of ends really, or hopefully begins for kind of a lot of these artists. And people, you know, around the world listen to this might not realise that Sound City, if you're a musician in Liverpool, if you're a band, it's something you kind of aspire to, like, oh, get on that. So for these young people to get that opportunity is incredible, really.
Yeah, I think I think the partnerships here, you know, between LFC and, you know, Levi's and Liverpool Lighthouse, which is the youth project, which is kind of housing it, and Sound City have been tremendous, because everybody's trying to put their best foot forward, but once again, to the betterment of the project. So no one's trying to pull it in different ways. You know, it makes sense that this project ends at Sound City, because Sound City is a great place to discover new talent, but it's a great incubator for, you know, careers. You know what I mean? It Sound City's two way. It's you know, it's a great networking opportunity and great showcase opportunity. But, you know, even for local artists, it is pretty much the start, you know, as you launch your career, do you know what I mean? And sometimes, you know, the other side of it, when you've actually made it and you come back. So I think that's really exciting. And once again, for them to be able to perform at that event, but also support Loyal Carner, who's a headliner, you know, you're going to have all these people that probably will know these artists come and see them and discover them. And I've got ultimate faith that a lot of people are going to be surprised by what they see, and a lot of the artists on this project are going to gain new fans.
I can't wait to kind of hear really and see what you guys come up with and what kind of everyone comes up with really. And I think it's, you know, a bit more kind of on the project generally. I looked around to see what else did the kind of, you know, I'd heard of the project where I knew the stuff that Dad had done in London. But when you look at the cities, it's kind of New York, San Francisco. It's all the big cities where you think of the music. And Liverpool deserves to be up there, doesn't it? You know, we can be a bit kind of like, I don't know, timid about ourselves sometimes. Like, you know, Liverpool is a musical powerhouse where all around the world people know about it. And we just need to kind of shout about ourselves a bit more, I think.
Well, I think, you know, projects like this, Lymph Academy, Sound City, Music Week, all these things, I feel like, are part of this new narrative. It's a collective voice that's saying, you know, we are shouting outside the city, because I think us Scousers, sometimes we talk to each other and tell each other how great we are, but sometimes we don't shout outside the city. But, you know, I think it's a new collective voice that is like literally going, you know what, pay attention to us and pay attention to the talent here. You know what I mean? Because we've had, from the late 50s through to early noughties, we had tremendous homegrown talent that was breaking out and doing great things. Last 10, 15 years, it's been a little bit quieter, do you know what I mean? We have, you know, Circle Waves and Lapsley and people like that come through, but I think we've just got to keep pushing through, and it's projects like this that I believe give those opportunities, because that's all I feel like we're ever asking for. Give us a level playing field, no pun intended, give us a level playing field and see how good we can play. That's all we ask. And projects like this give us a level playing field, and I think that's important.
So tell us a bit more about the young people who are involved. And I think in a few months' time, we're going to be speaking to some of them. But in terms of, you know, the range of talent you've got, the range of skills, kind of, you know, presumably some people are kind of good at different things. Like, what kind of boys and girls have you got in there?
It's mad. We've got a totally diverse set, you know. And when I say diverse, I'm talking like musically diverse, skill-wise. You know, we got producers, straight-up producers. We've got musicians, we've got vocalists, we've got people who are really good at songwriting, people who aren't so great at songwriting but are great vocalists. We've got people, you know, who have a bit more experience, bedroom producers, producers who've worked in groups. You know, it's exciting. It's a challenge to us, you know, to the team. You know, don't get it twisted when I see the list of people. I was like, oh, wow, let's see how this goes. But, you know, I'm from a generation that believes, and I always come from a perspective that believes that if you can find something that unites people, that's what they're going to focus around. So like skill level, experience, different backgrounds, it goes out the window when it's like they've got this commonality. And that's what we kind of focused on for the first 3 or 4 weeks. And I've seen already like what I think are going to be like lifelong relationship builds, because you're probably like me. It's like we've got our older generation. So you've got like the guys from like Cast, and you've got people like Kevin McManus, and you've got Dave Pitchling, and all them are tight in it for 20 years. They've all worked together, and I used to go, I wonder if I'll be like that. I wonder if, you know, the guys from like yourselves, you know, will we in 20 years be like our kids? We'll be like, oh, you look after my kid. But I feel like that's what we're seeing here. You're seeing the start of something, and it all starts with respect, isn't it? It's about people looking and respecting what other people do. And I feel like this project is, they've done a great job, the people who have helped recruit these, you know, who've selected these young people, because they've put something in a melting pot, which is uniquely like Liverpool, just a melting pot of talent. And I believe that it's good governance on the project, which means that, you know, they're all going to learn from each other and grow together. And I think they won't forget this six-month project for a long, long time.
They've done a great job getting you involved as well, man. I do mean that, honestly. I do mean that. I was delighted when they said you were involved. And it's a great thing going on here. The Anfield Rap, listen, we're going to be telling the story of this from now right through to the performances of Sound City. So make sure you're listening, not just the weekend. We're going to do little video stuff as well. Just telling the story and seeing where it ends up, and seeing these young people astound everyone at Sound City, hopefully. But yeah, in the meantime, I presume I'm going back to Neil.
Wasn't all that marvellous, excellent stuff across the board on the weekender. So Spurs at home, drilling back down into it. Amelia Bonner, Mike Nevin, and Adam Amelia. I've forgotten literally Adam's name.
We've got the same name, to be fair.
Yeah, yeah.
Amelia and Amelia.
Yeah, I haven't known each other.
I can't help that.
We've only known each other for over 10 years. 15 at the outside at this point, Adam. Yeah. It is the hardest game of the season, possibly, although the Eden Hazard show at Anfield does loom large in my psychology.
I'm more worried about that one, I think.
Because the Eden Hazard show?
Well, yeah, and we've got a poorer record against Chelsea than we have against Tottenham.
So this is one of the reasons why for you this isn't the big one?
No, it isn't. It isn't. This is
the rather large one.
Yeah, this is a big game. I expect Liverpool to win. You know, I've as home games are throughout the season.
Big one. No, excellent stuff. So yeah. Let me go all the way through here. I've got no idea what Tottenham are going to do. Just to sort of put that people in the context of that, Tottenham played against Dortmund home and away 3 at the back. It's worth remembering that. So don't be surprised if Tottenham turn up and do three at the back.
Was Dyer one of them? Because he's injured, isn't he?
No, he wasn't. It will. Sanchez, the lad whose name I can't say in Vertonghen. I can say Foyth, and he played the first leg, but not the second. So there's that. Also, Spurs are a bit thin. Dyer, you mentioned there. Injuries, couple of midfield questions. So, ultimately, as ever, I am doing the pick me a team thing. Mike, I said teasingly at the end of part one, I think he might do Oxlade-Chamberlain, give him a rest, give him a little bit longer off before he uses him a great deal home and away. Trent Alexander-Arnold. And I think he may well go with Gomez right back as part of the reintegration of Joe Gomez. But what do you think he's going to do?
I think it's a bit too soon for Gomez, to be honest. I can see you thinking behind sort of throwing him in and see how he gets on, but it feels like too big a game to make your first appearance in, you know, whatever it is, 5 months since December. For me, it's really all about you know, sort of the midfield balance, and you know that's been the conundrum all season. What does Keita get reintroduced? He hasn't played for a while. Shaqiri's completely disappeared from the scene. I can't see him coming back in a game of this magnitude. Albeit that I can see him at some point before the end of the season. I pretty much sort of picks itself. I think it'll be a very familiar Liverpool lineup. Henderson probably. I think Henderson plays. I think Wijnaldum plays, and then it's probably Fabinho. But you know, I think that's basically Liverpool's chosen best three in midfield.
Yeah, it is just about basically saying pick me a midfield when you say pick me a team, because
the front three,
and I think probably unless he does something with Gomez and Trent or Gomez and Matic, which I don't think he will,
or Gomez and the big dog.
I just don't see that. He
loves throwing Lovren back in.
Yeah, I just...
He literally, honestly, it's his favourite thing in footy. More than winning. Gomez, more than doing that thing in front of the cop at the end. He loves a mad Dejan Lovren.
Gomez being available and him throwing Lovren back in would seem like a real stab in the heart to me personally. Oh, Gomez is back. Here's frigging Lovren. I think we're just saying pick me a midfield three. And
I can't believe you all think he's going to go with the same back four. I'm genuinely surprised. Given all of his form, given what he's about, given the fact that he will play Dejan Lovren at any opportunity,
he's been on the bench for the last three games though, Lovren.
He's not been fit. I think he's now got him where he wants.
I don't know. Go on. I just think there's something going on with Lovren. Something.
I can't forget the sight of Dejan Lovren misjudging a header against Spurs, albeit at Wembley, by about 34.
But then he picked him against him at Anfield last season.
I think he's enjoying not having to go through that the ups and downs of Dejan Lovren. And I don't know. I can see him leaving at the end of the season. Anyway, the only thing I was basically going to say the same as Mike, which is Gini, Fab, Henderson, except that Henderson played a lot for it. Played quite a bit for England, and so it depends on him.
I think that's a good thing. He doesn't get loads of plaudits from Liverpool fans. I mean, on social media, if you like. But I think there was a lot of nice things said about Henderson's performances for England, and he personally will have got a boost from that.
I didn't see the first one. I saw the second, but the second one where he came on, he was really good. Set up a great goal for Sterling, and then kicked off on someone, which was Boss.
You know, aside from the outside influence of what people are saying about you, if you've had two good games, then you're raring to go again. And I think Henderson's situation at Liverpool, being the captain but not always playing, I think that must play on your mentality.
Yeah.
Because you, as captain of the club, really speaking, you should be playing every game, and he doesn't. So he realises there's a threat to his place. So any situation whereby he can feel a bit better about himself, I think is a really good thing. And I'll never really call on England to do me any favours, but I think in this situation, I'm happy with that.
Yeah, I mean, and people, including kind of me, I suppose, were a little bit put out by the fact that he came back from injury and then reported for England duty, where he could have had a break like a few of our players did. But it was pointed out to me that he's getting his sharpness back on someone else's time, and I think that's actually what's happened. So I'm, you know, hold my hands up there. I was wrong about that one, and basically that was. it was a roundabout way of saying I agree with the midfield you picked anyway, Mike. So. Because it's either Henderson's
one for me.
Henderson's come back and he's not quite sharp, but he looked sharp. And in which case, I'd slot Milner in there. But I think it is going to be Fab Genie Henderson.
No one said Lallana's name yet. So.
No one said Lallana's name yet.
Maybe with good reason. I don't know. I don't know if this is the... I think he's been really, really good lately. I don't know if this is the game for him to continue being really good. I don't know.
He hasn't got away on international duty.
Yeah.
Nor does James Milner. And no one said James Milner's name yet either.
Yeah.
Well, you did, but you not picked
passing.
Him. You didn't give him the focus he deserves.
I mean, I said his name.
So the front three are the front three. It'll make me feel a lot calmer to not talk about the defenders being mixed. I'd just like to think that it's not going to happen, but then it will be, and I'll just be thinking of your face. But I don't know if I'd like to see Lallana start, or if that's just me being kind of like...
But ahead of who? Because presumably he's going to pick Fabinho, and presumably he picks Wijnaldum, because he loves picking Wijnaldum.
I think the thing with Lallana is he was out for so long, we'd all written him off, and then suddenly he comes back with what was... Let's face it, it was a decent performance in the
against
home game.
A less good team.
Was it Burnley?
Yeah.
But... If you put that in the context of Lallana 2-3 seasons ago, no one's saying he's had a good game. He charged down an incident first half, and which led to a goal, but there wasn't loads of creativity. He's good at holding the ball up, but I think basically the way that Lallana's performances in the last two games have to be placed in context from in terms of what people were expecting. And it's a nice surprise to see him relatively effective, but he's still nowhere near the player he was. And for that reason, I think that all of the other midfielders that we've talked about in terms of getting picked, they're way ahead of him still.
I don't know if it's a surprising performance in terms of what people expected of him, or a surprise performance in the face of a lot of people just absolutely fucking hating him for no real good reason. I think I'd almost say I'd like him not to be picked for this game so that I don't have to listen to people being annoyed that he's been picked for this game. Like, I partially agree with you, but I feel like I'm somehow geared to defend Lallana.
Well, there's a strange little run of fixtures where I think it's odd for him at Southampton. I think we've seen that in the past, that when he goes back there, it can be... he's not really performed. Then there's Porto, so there's the Spurs, then the Southampton, Porto. In the middle of the Porto games, that's where you've got your Chelsea at home, where again, we'd all be sitting here saying, I'm not really sure about Lallana.
There's some games there where he can start after that, I think. And I don't like him as a sub. That's another Lallana thing that I quite like him starting at Anfield against certain opposition. Basically, I think that's his role now for me this season.
I think the manager's going to want James Milner on the pitch in the last half an hour of every game.
I thought that actually that was one of the things I was thinking when I was not picking him, because I was thinking about how he's coming off the bench and sorting out whatever issues it is that need sorting for the last 20 minutes.
With the exception of Evan away, unless the issue was the ball's not in touch enough.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sort of continuing with my theory of the last 20 minutes, but he shouldn't do anything for 5 minutes, just sit down. but yeah, I enjoyed the picture of him running through traffic in Dubai. It was good.
Yeah,
he looked really cool, like he was Will Smith or something.
He always looks really cool these days. Yeah. Never has a man grown into his face more at a younger age than James Milner.
So whenever he lifts up his top to like wipe the sweat off his face, and you remember that he's really fit. Do you know what I mean? That you're just like, how are you hiding that? But yeah,
he's one hell of a job. All right then,
like a fireman or something.
Yeah.
Like I think you seem relatively like Flanders. There is
stupid sexy Flanders.
The end of this one is going to be the approach, and you said before you feel as though it's going to be quite tight. For me, I feel as though if Liverpool get something from it, firstly, two things I think. One, the scorer of the second goal in the game is crucial. I think this is a second goal game, not a first goal game. And I think if Liverpool can get themselves 2-0 up, I think it becomes in Tottenham's interests to stem the bleeding as much as trying to rebuild through the game because of what the challenges they've got to come, which is Champions League and top four, which if they go with 2 points a game, they've got a lot of home games left as well, Spurs. I'm talking a lot here, but I need to say that. And this home games, they've got it quite straightforward. Us and City away are their only real headaches. Everything else, they should win. So I think that's there. But your concern is this one becomes a bit of an epic.
Well, I think all of these games potentially become epic at this stage of the season. Any game where you're not winning after an hour. And I feel like I've been saying this since October. I remember feeling this against Watford away when it was 0-0 after an hour, and then Liverpool score, and they end up winning 3-0. just the relentless nature of it, the needing to win games, draws not being good enough. I think that, you know, that pervades all fixtures. But this one, because it's the quality of the opposition, really. So if it goes down to the last half hour, and it's level, then there's two things that can happen. There can be something that's incredibly deflating, which is conceding a goal, or there's something that actually fires you on. And in some ways, I think Liverpool are best served by a narrow victory late on than they are by winning 3-0. Because I don't think winning 3-0 proves anything. Because we've seen Spurs collapse at Anfield before, not too much last season, but certainly in last 10, 15 years. And I genuinely believe that a hard fought 2-1 with a goal 10, 15 minutes from time, that's seismic in terms of what it does for people's minds. Focus. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. I just also don't want the pain of it.
Yeah, I mean,
what about the passion?
What about the glory?
I would like us to score after 10 minutes and then every 10 minutes thereafter. Every game this season remaining.
We're not playing Crystal Palace.
No, I know. But I think that I can kind of see that. But I sort of think, are we haunted by ghosts of 2014? I think we comfortably beat Tottenham a couple of games before we ended up messing up against Chelsea last time. And it's sort of the way these fixtures have fallen, there is like portents of doom everywhere. But yeah, I
so we beat Spurs 4-0 and then lose to Chelsea.
And then lose to Chelsea, yeah. So you can sort of, you know, that's there in history. But I think that there will be a lot of work getting the players' heads right. And I think they're right already. So I sort of think that you're right in terms of fan psychology, Mike, but I think that player psychology, that they'll be happier doing it the 3-0 way. No one's mentioned that Poch has got a touchline ban, by the way. I know I said it before the show started, so that's, you know, it's another one along with Mother's Day and the clocks changing, which might slightly alter.
I'm going to make a serious point. I think you're right in terms of like the players' mentality at this point, right? And that might be fine for Sunday, but when you get down to the last three,
yeah,
honest to God, it is a different thing, because this is their entire careers, and becoming Liverpool legends. It's going to be hard.
I know the one
and we're still fighting that whole, you know, sort of weight of history, not so much weight of the shirt, because they've disproved that theory, but.
I keep thinking about how this is, if it gets there, how Newcastle away is going to be really, really hard.
Yeah,
and it's going to be horrendous, and we'd not really thought about it.
Yeah. I'm terrified. Newcastle away is very much on my
Newcastle
radar.
And Cardiff are both quite frightening. I think.
I haven't even thought about Wolves on the last day. If we need to win,
no,
they're good Wolves.
But they are good. What you could do without that.
But best if they get to the FA Cup final, though.
That'll be a bonus.
Might be playing the Aussies.
Yeah.
Prediction.
Oh, can I go last? Because I feel like I jinx it if I go first. Sorry,
Adam.
2-0.
Michael. I've already said mine, 2-1 to Liverpool, late goal, 15 minutes from time.
Yeah, I reckon that.
You're going with that, with the Mike Nevin view. Thank you to everyone who's done the weekend of this week, and the three people in front of me, Amelia Bonner, Mike Nevin and Adam Melia. Liverpool up against the might that is Tottenham Hotspur, who are now no wins in four as they turn up to Anfield and face Liverpool down. It's huge. I think we're going to win. Sports Social Podcast Network.